We want to acknowledge that we are gathered this morning on the traditional land of the Potawatomi and the Miami peoples, past and present, and honor with gratitude the land itself and the people who have stewarded it through the generations. This calls us to commit to continuing to learn how to be better stewards of the land we inhabit as well. I'm growing to appreciate hearing this acknowledgement in our gatherings. I find that I'm challenged to think in ways that I had not been brought up to do, to think about my place on a historical continuum, to recognize not only my privileges and my prosperity, but to realize that much of that prosperity was created for me through violence and oppression of others, to think about my ancestors. Why was I never told about my ancestors? To reflect upon my footprints. Many of them are tar-covered and leaving deep stains. And this morning, to think about my descendants, not just my own children and my grandchildren, but the future generations of the Potawatomi and the Miami, and others that God calls me to love as neighbors. We know our current economic system, capitalism, is based on exploitation, not nurture. Just like it took external pressures to force the tobacco industry to put warning labels on cigarette packages, we can't expect the oil industrialists and the utilities to stop doing what they're doing without protest and without legislation. And since we are all heavily invested in and dependent on their products, it becomes hard to imagine a new way of living without them. In recent years, it's been popular to blame the fossil fuel industrialists for failing to take appropriate action. After all, Exxon knew in 1977 that carbon dioxide accumulation was most likely caused by the combustion of fossil fuels. Scientists from the 19th century were starting to be concerned. But it isn't just the capitalists that love the money to be made. We have all succumbed to the seduction of cheap energy, the power, the mobility, and the convenience offered by burning the product of ancient sunlight. And what would it actually be like to heed the call to shut it all down? I can't imagine it. Can you? Really? The New Yorker magazine recently published a commentary by author Jonathan Franzen entitled, "What If We Stop Pretending?" While he speaks out strongly against the conservative voice that refuses to acknowledge the reality of the climate crisis, he also challenges those on the left, saying, "If you care about the planet and about the people and the animals who live on it, there are two ways to think about this. You can keep hoping the catastrophe is preventable and even become even more frustrated and enraged by the world's inaction, or you can accept that this disaster is coming and begin to rethink what it means to have hope." He points out that 30 years ago, it might have been possible to roll up our sleeves and save the planet, but it's too late now to think that we can avert the problems caused by our overconsumption and neglect. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC, tells us that to limit the temperature rise to 2 degrees Celsius, not only would we have to reverse the trend of the last three decades, we would need to approach net zero emissions globally in the next three decades. And more recently published research indicates that even this underestimates the pace of warming. Franzen goes on to observe that human psychology, political reality, and the fact that carbon savings achieved through renewable energy has been more than offset by increased consumer demand. This makes draconian measures very unlikely to succeed. Even if you could convince millions of government-hating Americans to accept the costs and curtailments that would be needed to impose on their lifestyles, you would have to convince them to set aside nationalism, classism, and racism, to think beyond the comforts of the day, to prepare for a better world for future generations. Needless to say, he's pretty skeptical. So he wonders what might happen that if instead of denying reality, either from the climate deniers or from the climate activists, we told ourselves the truth. We will experience the consequences of global warming. We need to start figuring out how to adapt. We need to face that in many parts of the world, droughts and floods in eastern Africa, communities in the Arctic collapsing under the permafrost that has disappeared, island nations in the Pacific that are being swallowed up by rising sea levels, frequently reoccurring superstorms, that the consequences have already arrived. We most likely will face massive refugee movements because of large populated areas that are becoming uninhabitable. He isn't calling us to give up. Even if we can't avoid the 2-degree warming target, there's still a strong practical and ethical case for reducing our carbon emissions. Half measures are better than no measures. If we can avoid a single hurricane through cutting back, that would be worth pursuing. But instead of insisting on technology to save us, while it might help, it's time to face the fact that the world is already encountering the results of our refusal to face the truth. Listen to the Pope earlier this month as he spoke at the World Day of Prayer for the Care of Creation. This is a season for undertaking prophetic actions. Many young people all over the world are making their voices heard and calling for courageous decisions. They feel let down by too many unfulfilled promises, by commitments made and then ignored for selfish interests or out of expediency. The young remind us that the earth is not a possession to be squandered, but an inheritance to be handed down. They remind us that hope for tomorrow is not a noble sentiment, but a task calling for concrete actions here and now. We owe them real answers, not empty words, actions, not illusions. He goes on to say, in this regard, the forthcoming United Nations Climate Action Summit coming up this September 23rd is of particular importance. Their governments will have the responsibility of showing the political will to take drastic measures to achieve as quickly as possible zero net greenhouse gas emissions and to limit the average increase in global temperature to 1.5 degrees Celsius with respect to pre-industrial levels in accordance with the Paris Agreement goals. Let's take up these opportunities to respond to the cry of the poor and of our earth. And listen to the scientists. Just this week, I sat in the 4th Annual Indiana Climate Summit held here at Goshen College. Jeff Dukes, the director of the Purdue Climate Change Research Center, shared about the local impacts on this global crisis in different regions of Indiana. Everything from health, agriculture, tourism, water, infrastructure, all have local consequences. He shared data showing that the temperature has climbed 1.2 degrees since 1895, but computer models suggest climbs are from 5 to 6 degrees by the mid-21st century, Fahrenheit. The outcome of these changes are easy to imagine. There will be a change in the number of extreme temperature days, the nature and frequency of severe storms, what is able to grow and what is not able to grow, and many other consequences. Perhaps one of the most unsettling things he illustrated was that at this point, what we might do now to mitigate this crisis won't really change the outcome for the next 20 years. The temperature climb and the consequences leading up to 2040 are already on course from our previous 30 years of inaction. The importance of mitigation now is to break the trend to protect our environment beyond the mid-century mark until the end of the century. Half of all fossil fuels consumed globally since the beginning of the industrial age have been consumed since 1988. Fossil fuel demand in this country rose 4% in 2018 to an all-time high, and globally the increase was 2.6%. Essentially, all the carbon dioxide offset by the increases in the usage of alternative energy sources so far, such as wind and solar, have been subsumed by increased consumption of fossil fuels. What can be done? Well, we might be able to construct massive solar or wind farms, continue to find ways to harness the atom, and/or come up with that perfect battery. The most widely discussed options of finding new sources of energy involve taxing carbon. Placing a cost per ton on carbon dioxide and moving to reflect the true cost of this energy, not just the first cost. In this way, we might find a way to reluctantly constrain ourselves from our seemingly insatiable desire, our insatiable appetite. Whatever we're able to do to face this crisis, either through mitigation or simply adaptation, will require major shifts in our political realities and our economy. Confused about what to do? Well, I'm pretty convinced that Edward R. Murrow was correct when he said, anyone who isn't confused really doesn't understand the situation. Greta Thunberg. Quick show of hands. How many of you are familiar with Greta Thunberg? Good, good. If not, it's time for you to meet her. Last year, about this time, 15-year-old Greta felt compelled to skip school for three weeks to sit outside the Swedish Parliament building to persuade the government to live up to its commitments to the Paris Climate Agreement. When Greta was 8 years old, she first heard adults talking about the climate crisis, and she couldn't understand, if it was so serious, why it wasn't the most talked about topic on television. At the age of 11, she went into a deep depression, refusing to eat and refusing to talk. She lost over 20 pounds and was diagnosed with Asperger's syndrome, obsessive compulsive disorder, and selective mutism. Selective mutism, meaning if you don't have anything to say, you don't say it. We could use a bit more of that disorder in this world. While she acknowledged that for a while this diagnosis limited her, she now claims it as her superpower, and she has plenty to say. Last August, she explained her protest on social media, and the movement went viral. After 3 weeks, she continued to skip school every Friday in what has become Fridays for Future. Millions of students from around the world have joined her. I want you to know that now, because out of that movement, this coming Friday, September 20th, will be the largest international climate strike ever, where students are inviting people of all ages to join them, find some place to join them. And to bring this home, an article in Wired magazine quoted Amazon employees who signed a petition to their employer and plan to join the walkout. It's incredibly important that we show up and support the youth who are organizing this kind of thing, because I think it's really important to show them, hey, you have allies in the tech too, says Weston Fribley, a software engineer who has worked at Amazon for 4 years. Go, Weston. I'd like to yield a few minutes now of my time this morning to Greta. This is from her speech last December at the Climate Summit for the COP, Conference of Parties, the decision-making body of the European Union.
My name is Greta Thunberg. I am 15 years old, and I'm from Sweden. I speak on behalf of Climate Justice Now. Many people say that Sweden is just a small country, and it doesn't matter what we do. But I've learned that you are never too small to make a difference. And if a few children can get headlines all over the world just by not going to school, then imagine what we could all do together if we really wanted to. But to do that, we have to speak clearly, no matter how uncomfortable that may be. You only speak of green, eternal economic growth because you are too scared of being unpopular. You only talk about moving forward with the same bad ideas that got us into this mess, even when the only sensible thing to do is pull the emergency brake. You are not mature enough to tell it like it is. Even that burden you leave to us children. But I don't care about being popular. I care about climate justice and a living planet. Our civilization is being sacrificed for the opportunity of a very small number of people to continue making enormous amounts of money. Our biosphere is being sacrificed so that rich people in countries like mine can live in luxury. It is the sufferings of the many which pay for the luxuries of the few. The year 2078, I will celebrate my 75th birthday. If I have children, maybe they will spend that day with me. Maybe they will ask me about you. Maybe they will ask why you didn't do anything while there still was time to act. You say you love your children above all else, and yet you are stealing their future in front of their very eyes. Until you start focusing on what needs to be done rather than what is politically possible, there is no hope. We cannot solve a crisis without treating it as a crisis. We need to keep the fossil fuels in the ground, and we need to focus on equity. And if solutions within the system are so impossible to find, then maybe we should change the system itself. We have not come here to beg world leaders to care. You have ignored us in the past, and you will ignore us again. We have run out of excuses, and we are running out of time. We have come here to let you know that change is coming, whether you like it or not. The real power belongs to the people. Thank you.
Since that speech in December, Greta has had an amazing opportunity to speak in front of numerous groups of world leaders throughout Europe. So far, it's estimated over $1 billion have been redirected to address the climate crisis. It's being called the Greta Effect. If you've been following recent news, Greta arrived in the United States last month by means of a net zero energy yacht sailing across the Atlantic because she refuses to fly in an airplane. Her example has already made an impact on the amount of air travel in Europe, as others have chosen to follow her lead. Since arriving in New York, she's had several interviews on national media, participated in a protest in front of the White House just this Friday, and will be the featured speaker at the UN climate conference that the Pope mentioned coming up on September 23rd. If you don't get anything else from this morning, be sure to start paying attention to Greta. But some of you may be thinking, I thought this was a series on finance and stewardship. Well, so let me shift a little bit. I'll draw much of the remainder of my time this morning from a book written by Scott Russell Sanders entitled A Conservationist Manifesto. Dr. Sanders is a distinguished professor of English at Indiana University in Bloomington, where he currently resides. I first heard him speak at a conference of Indiana College sustainability managers several years ago. We swim in an ocean of consumerism, seemingly unending supply of inexpensive energy, capitalism, and what is commonly understood as the Protestant work ethic. If you don't work, you don't get to eat. It's very difficult for us to imagine a life, at least human activity, without these foundational understandings. While our dog Bilbo would be more like the dog in the story here, he seems to get along just fine from day to day with, if he gets food, sleep, maybe a walk or two, a little companionship. Much of our human energy and activity involves what shall we wear, what needs fixing, what shall we do, what have we accomplished, and what remains to be done, and how we're going to pay those bills. Many of us spend a great deal of thought about how we will be entertained, what will be our next vacation. And most of these things that we think about depend on fossil fuels. Sanders says that we've been sold on the idea of the American way of life. It's mostly a cheat and a lie. This dream of endless consumption, endless novelty, and endless play is bad for us and bad for the earth. Instead, he says we need a dream of simplicity over novelty, conservation over consumption, harmony over competition, and community over ego. We need an imagination that instead of accumulating private wealth we hold as individuals or corporations, we need a commitment to commonwealth as we share as members of the human family and residents of our common planet. Let me read a little bit. As I understand it, the commonwealth embraces much more than body politic commonwealth. It embraces all those natural and cultural goods that we share by virtue of our membership in the human family. A short list of those goals would include air, water, soils, the ocean, outer space, the electromagnetic spectrum, the human gene pool, the diversity of species, language in all its forms, including math and music, knowledge in all its forms, art to zoology, all manner of artifacts and machines, from stone scrapers to supercomputers, the practical arts of cooking, building, herding, and farming, the practice of medicine, the body of law, structures of democratic government in the tradition of civil liberty, parks, community gardens, state and national forests, wildlife refuges, libraries, museums, and the list goes on. The work of creating wise and loving communities begins with cherishing our common wealth. I speak of it as common because it's ordinary and also because it's shared. The word derives from a verb meaning to exchange or to barter. It suggests a giving and a receiving. The etymology of wealth leads back to weal or well. To be wealthy means, at root, to be well, to flourish. So commonwealth embraces all those shared conditions and gifts necessary for human flourishing. Let's think a bit about the old idea of the commons. In European contexts, it often represented the lands and the waters used by the community as a whole. Pastures, woodlots, community growing fields, lakes, rivers. If the land was owned by a feudal lord, a church, or a monarch, it was still at least partly understood to be available for use by those who lived near it. As a child, I grew up in such an area in Michigan. Much of the land around our home was state property. There was a state recreational park nearby, but also thousands of acres of state forests and preserves. It was designated around its borders with little rectangular signs telling us that this was public land, open for hunting and hiking and free to explore. I grew up with little sense of boundaries. Even the farms and the homes around that weren't state land were understood to be fine for us to explore and play in. I wandered freely and without a sense of what was private property. As a child, I understood that fences were something you climbed over, meant to keep livestock from wandering, but not something to keep you out. I literally had to learn that such boundaries meant for most people. I had to learn that as an adult. I was startled and still remember the first time I was scolded for walking through a neighbor's yard. I've never been comfortable with fences as boundaries. While maybe not as widespread as I experienced as a child, I like Goshen because of its sense of commons. I don't take them for granted. Shanklin Park, Shoup Woods, the Mill Race, Fiddler's Pond, bike trails, Whitmer Woods, and in most contexts, even Goshen College campus. Hopefully, our playground out here can be seen as common goods in this neighborhood. As history illustrates, one of the biggest collisions of culture came when the Europeans colonized the Americas and began carving up North America's commons into private property. Whether you think about the purchase of the Manhattan Island in exchange for trinkets, or the treaty signed that ultimately evicted the Potawatomi from this part of the Midwest, turning the common land into private property, we changed the role of earth as a place to care for the livelihood of the community into a commodity to be bought and sold for the benefit of the propertied few. If you didn't hold property or work for someone who did, you starved. Like it or not, the story for many of us includes the establishment of our own private wealth, which is wrapped up in this history. A few weeks ago, Mitch Rose reflected on his family farm in Iowa that was purchased from the government to settle and develop land that used to be the shared home of indigenous people. His story is certainly not unique. Fortunately, there's a counter-narrative told by many people, including many in this congregation and in this community. There is an intentionality to care for the common wealth. To list a few of Goshen's common efforts, there would be the Goshen Urban Forest, 45 by 45. The Elkhart River Restoration Association, Friends of the Pumpkin Vine Trail, the Interfaith Hospitality Network, Elkhart County Jail Ministry, Walnut Hills, CCYC, Maple City Healthcare Center, Mosaic, La Casa, Habitat, The Window, and the Restore, the Depot, Elkhart County Fair, Downtown Goshen, the Good of Goshen, Mennonite Relief Sale. Marshall King wrote an article recently in the South Bend Tribune describing a fundraiser for Basher Homes. Don Phillips, president and CEO of that agency that works with troubled children and their families, said he's always amazed at how people come out to support Basher, its staff, and those they serve. We can do things others can't do in other communities because of this community, he said. Marshall goes on to describe the nature of the fundraiser in his usual Marshall-esque images and concludes by saying, a small fundraising event generates $100,000. Many hit $250,000. Last year's Running with Spoons raised $450,000, making it the largest fundraiser in Basher's history. The largest of these fundraising events in this county raised more than $1 million. This way of supporting those in our community has become part of our economy and part of our tradition of generosity. Even in this congregation, we're frequently reminded by Joanna of what the possibilities are for school kit bags to bring hope to those displaced by violence and, going forward, those whose lives will be displaced by the climate crisis. We've developed our 2% fund with a vision for acknowledging economic disparities and until recently have been able to ensure that a third of our budget was directed to needs outside our congregation. There are many examples of how this community and congregation contribute to the greater good. As we are slowly getting settled into our new space, I wonder how we're going to find ways for this building to contribute to the common wealth. If we're to have hope in the coming days, it resides in the maintaining and the restoration of our common wealth. Let it flourish. Second hour, Sandy Fribley and Ben Byler will be leading us in a lively conversation, I'm sure, about capitalism, the climate crisis, and yes, the little red hen. I encourage you to join us. I'll conclude again by quoting from Scott Russell Sanders. Love of our commonwealth is a root impulse behind countless acts of gratitude and kindness that ordinary people perform every day. We all feel it, but we don't always know how to speak of it, or if we speak of it so quietly that our story is drowned out by the blare of consumerism. We need to speak up to say boldly why we fight for a just economy, inspiring schools, decent housing, and universal health care, why we protect open space, why we clean up rivers and replant forests, why we look after the ailing and the elderly, and why we insist that government be a force for public good. In a society obsessed with competition, we need to say why we practice cooperation. In a culture addicted to instant gratification, we need to champion long-term healing. The glorification of private wealth will go on around the clock in every medium without any help from us. We need to counter that chorus by lifting our voices in praise of the wealth we share, recalling how our lives depend on one another, on generations past and generations future, on the bountiful earth and all its creatures, on the spirit that lifts us into being and sustains us through every moment and reclaims us ultimately in the end.